You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 191.
If no producer, no movie. Dino De Laurentiis.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so, so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro.
Well, guys, today on the show, we have legendary film producer Cary Woods. Cary has he's produced some films that have been very, very important in my life over the years, and I'm just going to list off a handful of the projects that he's produced, from So I Married an Axe Murderer, Rudy, Kids, the legendary Swingers, Scream, Copland, M. Night Shyamalan's first film, Wide Awake, and even going all the way from indie to the big budget Godzilla from the 90s. I mean, Cary has done it all. And I wanted to have Cary on the show to just dive into what he does, what a producer does, and to discuss these amazing films and how he got involved with them and so on. So this is really not only entertaining, but also fairly educational. So get ready to take some notes. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Cary Woods. I'd like to welcome to the show Cary Woods. How you doing, Cary?
Thank you very much. Love being here.
I've been a fan of your work as a producer for many years. Me coming up in the 90s as a young filmmaker, I was influenced by many of the films that you worked on. And we're gonna go down memory lane a little bit, and I'm sure from our other conversations, I know that you've got some good stories.
Well, I'm flattered.
So, how did you get started in the business?
I went to Southern California to go to law school, mm-hmm. And I did so at the University of Southern California Law School. Not long thereafter, I realized I didn't really want to be a practicing lawyer, and I loved film. And being a guy from the Bronx, the notion that I was going to come to California and end up in the film business would have been like you're telling me I was going to be an astronaut. But if you are in Southern California and you throw a stone, you're going to hit somebody who either is or who has a relative in the film business, film or television business, which I did at law school. And nonetheless, long story short, I made my way into the William Morris mailroom after law school.
Very cool. And that's where many a career has started.
Excuse me?
That is how many of a career in Hollywood have started.
It's I'm definitely not alone with the William Morris mailroom as a starting place.
Now, how did you get from the mailroom to producing your first project?
Well, my first project. Do you mean as a film producer?
As a film producer, correct.
Well, I had ended up working as an executive at Sony Pictures for John Peters and Peter Guber. I was hired as an executive working for them. And when it seemed I just didn't want to be a studio executive, I wanted to be a movie producer. And I had a friend, Rob Fried, who had a production deal at Columbia, which is where I was. And I was given a deal there. And Rob had been working on a movie called So I Married an Axe Murderer. And I think at the time he was developing it and Chevy Chase was attached to play the lead. But we weren't getting any traction. And I had a friend who was an agent at UTA. Her name was Cynthia Shelton, and she represented Mike Myers, who I was a gigantic fan of on Saturday Night Live. And she thought that the part would be great for Mike. So I said, well, you know, I love Mike. Let's see what he thinks. He reads the script. He really, really likes it. He wants to make a substantial amount of changes, but we love all of the ideas that he had. And he did make those changes. And then we were lucky enough to then have Wayne's World come out and pretty much make him the biggest comedy star in the world. And so TriStar, which was where the movie was set up, was thrilled to have Mike Myers now be the star of So I Married an Axe Murderer. And that was my first.
And you rode the Wayne's World tidal wave.
Well, you know, it's like when you have the guy who just starred in the biggest comedy of the year before starring in your comedy, and it's your first movie, it's kind of a stroke of luck.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also, so you worked with Peter Guber's, who are obviously, you know, legendary film producers. What were some of the lessons you took away from working with them?
Peter was incredibly, first of all, he was very, very smart, and you can't teach that, but he was an incredibly organized guy. So we would get on the plane, and he would take out a sheet of paper, and he would go over his to-do list. And his to-do list would be anywhere from 20 to 50 things that you would be constantly reviewing of things, projects that you were doing together. Mm-hmm. And so that you would basically, I mean, and there was no particular time of day that you would be going over them. We were together a lot, and he would go, "You have your to-do list?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, let's go through it." You know, and he'd be like, "Oh, okay, what's going on with this and what's going on with that?" And basically, it was just a sense that projects are constantly on, you know, mm-hmm. they're either moving forward or nothing's happening. And when you go through those lists, it's sometimes painfully obvious that you haven't done anything on something for a few days or a few weeks or whatever it is. But he was tightly in control of everything that he wanted to get done. So that was pretty much a pretty good learning experience.
So I've been asked so many times over my career what a producer does, Kerry. And, you know, the question is such a loaded question because there's so many different kinds of producers. But in your opinion, what does a producer do on a feature film, let's say?
Well, you know, so I'll go back and make that same pun, which is how long is a piece of string? I mean, really, there are so many different types of producers. I mean, I think one of the best ways to do it is to talk about it is that without whatever contribution that person made, there would be no movie. You know, that's a producer. If that person didn't exist, you would have never seen that movie. You can be a little bit less strict about it and say, okay, the movie wouldn't have been the same movie. It would have gotten made, but it would not have been the same movie without that person. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. The Academy actually has rules about it, which is that it used to be a member of the Academy Producers Guild, you had to have two credits, but they couldn't be shared amongst more than two people. So if you shared credit with one other person, you got a half a point and you needed four of those to equal two. If there were three or more, it counted for nothing. So that's the way the Academy strictly looked at producer. I don't know if it still does. I mean, I joined many years ago and I was asked, well, do you have four credits? And I said, well, yeah. But I didn't realize that that was the math that we use. I'd be curious to see if that's the way it's still done. But they basically were recognizing that it was two producers that were required. There now you can have, I don't even know how many producers. I don't even know if there is a number that isn't. Can you have 30? I don't know. I don't really know the answer.
I'll tell you what. I worked on a project that had 30 producers because I did the credits on it. Okay. And my God, it must have taken me 2 weeks just to do the credits because everybody's like, well, my name's above this and I have a shared card with this and where is how big's the font? Oh, it's insanity.
My guess would be that were it not for, I think there are probably a few of those that had they not existed, the film probably still would have existed.
Probably a couple.
So if you took the strict definition, then that would be it. I mean, you know, a producer makes the movie happen or doesn't. You know, either the movie wouldn't have happened or wouldn't have happened in the same way. Then there's no, and there are executive producers and
co-producers
all can make a significant contribution. I mean, line producers, the people are on the field actually putting the movie together physically. They don't often get producer credit. They get co-producer or associate producer or executive producer. They physically make the movie. Like I count them among people without whom there wouldn't be a movie, you know? So there's a lot of different kinds and basically some contribute and actually make the movie or make the movie better and some don't, you know, and that's what it comes down to.
So you made a movie earlier in your career that it obviously impacted me. And of course I can't watch it without crying even to this day, which is Rudy. How did you bring a story like that to the big screen? I mean, it doesn't seem like a automatic blockbuster idea.
Well, Rudy is the producer of the movie.
Right. Okay.
Rudy, you know, he felt that this was a movie. He felt his story was a movie. And there was a brilliant sports movie called Hoosiers, also an Indiana sports movie, that was written by Angelo Pizzo, the same person who, and Rudy loved that movie, and being Rudy, meaning he wasn't going to let anything get in his way, he came out to Los Angeles and he found Angelo Pizzo. And he said, I want to tell you my story. And Angelo, being the kind of guy he is, which he's a great guy, didn't slam the door in his face and said, yeah, I mean, come on in. And he starts telling him the story. And Angelo thinks, yeah, that's a movie. If that's a true story, that's a movie. And Angelo starts writing it. And I mean, Rudy is the, you know, the movie's about him, but he is the producer of the movie in many, many ways. He didn't get it made. But if you think about the person who first saw an idea, a story, and said, wow, that could be a movie. In this instance, that person was Rudy. And it was also Angelo after that who confirmed it and wrote it. But yeah, that's how that happened. And
how'd you get involved?
And I got involved because my partner, Rob Fried, this was one of the projects that he had percolating when we joined together at Columbia.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And it was right at the beginning of the project getting going. And then David Anspaugh, our director, met Sean Astin in Chicago and called us up and said, "I've got our Rudy." And he said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "I'm here with Sean Astin and Rudy." Rudy was involved in every part of that movie because he was just that kind of infectious guy. So he was just around all. And Rudy felt that Sean Astin should be Rudy. And then that was it. Now, at the time, Sean Astin wasn't a big star. Casting Sean Astin didn't really help us with the studio saying, "Oh, this is a star movie." But that Sean was perfect for the part, you know, obviously. And we just went at it. We said, "This is the guy who should be Rudy."
And then you peppered a bunch of good actors and very known respected actors around Sean to kind of round out the cast.
It was never really a cast heavy or star heavy thing. It was just based on the fact that it was a true story. I mean, we had tape of Joe Montana on the Sunday morning show where they asked him what was the most exciting sport. What happened, the most exciting moments for you in sports? And he starts to tell the Rudy story. He goes, "Well, when I was a sophomore at Notre Dame," he starts telling the story. This is Joe Montana. And we had this on tape that we were showing to the studio guys, you know, because we were saying, these are the kinds of people who are going to promote this movie for us. I mean, we did so much. There's so much into getting a studio behind the movie. I mean, one of the things that happened on this was because I had worked for Peter Guber before I, you know, turned it into a producing deal at Sony. I invited him to one of the Notre Dame games. That year, they were in the top 5 or 10. Mm-hmm. And there was a game against Michigan. If anybody's not a college football fan, this will bore you. But if you are, you're going to love it. And we invited him to come to that game. And, you know, we got him seats on the 50-yard line. And that morning, you know, they were going to fly in on the Sony jet. I had a bunch of our assistants put together a Notre Dame pack of, like, you know, a fanny pack and a scarf and gloves. And they were all put on each of their seats on the plane, without them knowing about it, so that when they came on the plane, they had all of this stuff flying out to South Bend for the game, where the plane was met on by the South Bend police force and driven into the stadium, you know, with, you know, police sirens blaring, and they were brought into the tunnel so that they could come in through the tunnel to their seats. I mean, we did like a whole thing. And, you know, they loved it. And obviously you want the studio to be, this was in the middle of production. You want the studio to be into your movie and to love it. Mm-hmm. But that matter as it relates to how much are they going to spend on it? What dates are they going to put it out and all of that? Plus it was incredible fun.
I can only imagine. Yeah. I remember seeing it in the theater. I remember when it came out, everyone was just, you know, it's one of those, it's always on the top 10 sports movies of all time, because of Rudy's story. It's pretty remarkable, honestly. His whole story.
Angelo Pizzo and David Anspaugh, the director, incredible talent. I mean, those same two guys did Hoosiers, which arguably is another movie among the top 10 best sports films. And like, same guys.
Yeah.
You know, and they're both Indiana. They both went to school at Indiana. They were college roommates. I mean, they are Indiana. You know, they're Indiana.
Now, how did you go from a film like Rudy, and I'm not sure if it was the very next one, but I know it was a couple movies down, to Kids, which is, you know, I remember going to the theater to see Kids. It's obviously the legendary Larry Clark made that. I remember seeing it in the theater. I don't know how old I was. I must have been, I was older than the kids in the movie, but not by much, probably about 5 or 6 years. And I just was like, how did this get made? How did this get out? And I remember hearing about, like, it's, you know, it's, there was so much hoopla about a film like that. How did you get involved in, with kids, and how did it come to life?
Well, I was Gus Van Sant's first agent at William Morris. And, you know, we obviously remained friends after I went off to be a producer. And he called me up and he said, you know, hey, look, I got this script, you know, Larry Clark is directing it. It's incredible. I mean, he just went on about how much he loved it and how much he loved this writer and blah, blah, blah. Would I read it? Because no one's going to make it. And I said, I'd love to read it. And I had literally about 3 weeks earlier met with these guys who were about to, they were going to invest about $5 to $10 million into the film business and were talking to me about things that we could potentially do together. So I read the script and he sent me that and Ken Park, two scripts that Harmony Korine wrote. And I literally either read them in the same night or one night after another. I couldn't believe what I was reading because it was so fresh and so original. Mm-hmm. He was writing about a generation that he was part of. And usually it takes about 7 to 10 years for somebody to become old enough to write about that generation. So if you're writing about 15 and 16 and 17 year olds, usually you're about 25 when you're good to start writing. But Harmony was writing it when he was 17. So he was living it and writing it. And it was incredible. And so he told me Harmony is coming to L.A. and would I meet him? And I did. And, you know, he looked like he was 15. And we just spent the day. I mean, I knew I was going to make the movie after I read the script. And then I flew to New York immediately to meet with Larry. And then that was it. I called the guys and I said, I think I found our first movie. And, you know, and I sent it to them. And, you know, they said, I mean, I'm still to this day not sure if they've ever read it or not, but I was extremely enthusiastic. And, you know, it was really, really fresh and exciting. And Larry had, I mean, talking to Larry, it was like he had directed 20 movies. He didn't have an iota of doubt about what he was going to do with that movie. And, you know, so we went forward.
And that kind of, I mean, and it was also a young Rosario Dawson was her first project. I mean, you guys literally plucked her off the stoop, didn't you, in New York, right?
Larry and Harmony were walking in the Lower East Side. And her mom, Rosario and her mom were on the stoop talking, and they heard her, and they heard the dialect, and they just stopped and walked over and said, you know, they just started talking to her and said, this is what we're doing. Would you like to be involved? I mean, Rosario doesn't have, you know, she's not in the movie all that much, but, you know, really important part, and obviously she's Rosario. She was fantastic. And yeah, it was just one of those things where they just passed by, heard her on the stoop. Her mother is an incredibly interesting woman too. And, yeah, that's exactly how it happened.
So I remember when that movie came out, I mean, it was obviously done independently. It wasn't done by a studio. If I'm correct, there wasn't a major studio behind that film.
Correct.
Right. So it was done independently. And I remember when it was coming out, there was just so much controversy about it because of the subject matter and kids and the sexuality of it all. And I just never seen something so raw and honest because I was a kid too. We all were, and we all knew what was going on during those years. I mean, that was a heightened version of that, no question, at least in that group of kids. But, how did you get this out? Because I remember there was like picket lines. People were like boycotting this thing to come out.
Well, I can tell you this. There was a lot of thought into it. I hired a lawyer called Arthur Garbers, who was one of the King's First Amendment law. He represented the New York Times. His daughter, Liz Garbus, is a pretty important documentary filmmaker right now. But we showed I anticipated that we could find ourselves people, you know, down south or wherever, actually challenging us legally. And so I wanted to have, you know, a legal opinion shutting that down before it could even happen. I mean, there was nothing about the film that in any way skirted the law, but I just wanted to be sure that we had all of our I's dotted and T's crossed. So Arthur Garbus, you know, was our First Amendment lawyer. So he did that. I mean, we were very, but we knew going in. I mean, we had, everybody was legal, you know, everything was done correctly because we knew what it was and we knew that it was dynamite. But at the same time, we were dealing with street kids. So you had to be extremely cautious about the way we went about things. A couple of the guys were sleeping, you know, at Larry's house or at Harmony's house, because otherwise there were times where you just wouldn't know if they would show up, you know.
That's how you kept an eye on them.
Well, yeah, you know, because I mean, they were excited to be in the movie, but you know, when the movie was done, they went back to being kids, you know, to being them, which meant they were out.
Right. And I saw another documentary about many of those kids, and they became, you know, just legends on the streets of Washington Square and all that. After that movie came out, it was one of those movies in the 90s, like, that only could be released in the 90s. I don't think that there's no way in God's green earth that kids could be released today in a theatrical experience. I don't think.
No, it's probably not.
There's just,
it couldn't get made then. You know, if that movie wasn't independently made, nobody was giving anybody the money to make that movie. I think that we had one shot and we were lucky and we took it and that was it. You know, but it was just one of those things where it all came together and I think we're better off having it.
I love that film too. I think it's one of those films that independent filmmakers should definitely watch, and it's such a almost cinema verite way of looking at it. You feel like a fly on the wall during that film. It is one of those quintessential 90s films, to say the least.
I can't tell you how many times people ask me how much of it was scripted. Mm-hmm. And how much of it was scripted was almost 90%. Virtually every word was scripted. There's the scenes, the girls talking scene where Larry and Harmony let them go, you know, just say, sure, just go for it. But other than that, every single word in that script was scripted, you know.
Remarkable. It seems so natural. It seems like it's dialogue that it's like there's no way someone sat down and wrote that. But
he was their peer. He was their friend. Harmony was a skater. Mm-hmm. And these guys were his friends, and he hung out with them, and he knew how they talked about things, and he, you know, so you couldn't possibly be, he was there. This was the kind of dialogue that he was part of every single day at that time. So,
remarkable. Now you also worked on another movie, which is essentially one of those quintessential 90s indie films, and there, you know, I always, you know, that whole time period of the 90s is where the independent film boomed again, and you know, from Mariachi to Brothers McMullen and Clerks and all of these films, and one of those films was Swingers, and Swingers was one of those films because for me, when it came out, it was one of those, I can't believe they made that, in the sense of like, how did they make that movie for such a small budget? How did you, can you tell me how that project came to be?
Well,
all of that stuff.
I came into it a little bit late, but here was my relationship to it. Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn were both in Rudy. Jon Favreau played Rudy's best friend. And Jon Favreau played the quarterback at the end, who's a little bit of an asshole. So I got to know them in that movie. John then went off and wrote And John and Vince were friends, and John went off and wrote that script.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Which is kind of a little bit of their story, of his and Vincent's story in Chicago. And Doug Liman, the director, originally John wrote it to direct it. And Doug Liman got the script and read it and wanted to direct it. And he offered to finance it. His father was a lawyer and he had clients and they were going to put together the money to finance it. And it wasn't a lot of money. And, you know, and John was going to star in it and he wrote it. So he agreed to that. He agreed to do that. So then the movie happened. And then when it was done, they weren't getting into festivals and they were having some. So they called me and they said, hey, would you look at this movie? You know, I think you may like it. And they were, you know, I'm like, sure. I loved it. I absolutely, it knocked me out. I couldn't believe how good, you know, much I loved it. And, you know, and then they did some work. They did some music stuff and they didn't get into Sundance. And I remember calling people about a couple of weeks before Sundance. I started to call around to the studios to set up screenings for people who were, you know, the heads of these studios saying, look, if you haven't been to Sundance yet, so you haven't spent any money, which is good because the most valuable film in Sundance this year is not going to be in Sundance. I'm going to send it to you right now. And essentially, they watched the film. You know, it wasn't in Sundance. And people started to like it. Now, eventually, Harvey Weinstein, with whom I had a deal, he really wanted it. He had to have it. And there was one other company whose highest level person who can see the movie had seen it and liked it. But in order to get it bought, the person who could say yes or no to that level of decision wasn't in the States and was going to be another day before he came back. And so basically it was like I either had to take Harvey Weinstein's offer, which he hasn't even said anything yet, or dance for a day or two until this guy got back to the United States without even knowing whether he was going to say yes, even if he did see it. So yeah. I really didn't have a sure thing. I had no other offers. I got a tremendous amount of pressure from Harvey Weinstein about selling it. He didn't know really that I didn't that the decision maker wasn't around. He didn't know that. He didn't know how long it would take for the guy to be back. You know, he just knew that I was holding out, you know, like he was going to see it any minute. And he finally said, well, you know, I said, hey, look, you know, if you want it, make me an offer that makes me take it off the table so that I don't do anything irresponsible to my partners, you know. And he said, okay, well, what's that number? And I told him, and it was a larger number than I think he thought, but he said yes. And so he got the movie, and he put it out.
Right.
I never was really happy with the way he put it out. I don't think that the movie, it gained a tremendous amount of acclaim and fame after its release. But mm-hmm. didn't have a really big box office
place. Right.
But he put it out. It is, you know, and then of course on video and streaming, it became a thing. But I don't think he really understood what it was when he put it out.
So let me ask you though, because I remember that if I remember correctly, because it's been a few years since then. The budget of that film was like $200,000, a quarter million, or something like that, right?
$250,000, yeah, quarter million.
Quarter million. So it was a $250,000 budget film, and Doug Liman made that movie look like it was made for at least $3 or $4 million, if not more.
Doug is a super, super talented guy. The casting was incredible. there was no stars in the movie. You know, Heather Graham was the only sort of known person in the movie.
Right.
But she didn't work at her anywhere near what her salary would have been. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he did a beautiful job. He's really talented. You know, and in those kinds of movies, the script was so good. You know,
right.
When you think about movies that don't cost a lot, it's the screenplay. You know, that screenplay was just sent. You know, what people remember about that movie is no one really remembers the shot. Everybody remembers a line. No one's come up to me like, oh, remember the shot when this happened? But they will come up to me and say, your money, you know?
Oh, God. I mean,
that kind of thing.
Oh, my God. How many lines? That movie is like one of the most quotable movies of the 90s. I mean, everybody was quoting that movie. And I was in college when that movie hit. And it was just like everybody was talking about Swingers and how they got it made and how it looked. And it looked so like such high production value. It's remarkable because do you think a movie like Swingers would even dent the world today in today's marketplace? I mean, the script is good, obviously. But
it's hard to know. I mean, the movie is a love story between these two guys.
Right.
They love each other.
Sure.
You know, John and Vince love each other. Is there room for, with a different backdrop, for two guys of that age really loving one another as friends? I think so. I mean, that's the kind of story. Those stories happen, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, you know, well-written and well-told, you know, not about swing music, but about around something else. I think it worked, you know. I mean, those are the kinds of human relationships that are going to always resonate one way or another. So,
and the investors of that film did okay.
Everybody did great.
I know. I remember I read something that Doug Liman was like, yeah, there were some dentists that we got some money from and they got a check back and they're like, when can we do more of these movies? Is this the way it always is?
Well, look, everybody did great, but John, Vince and Doug really did great. And it's right. Not because they all got rich on that movie, but their careers just all took off and their careers are incredible. All three of them have amazing careers right now.
Right. And Vince is, I mean, he built, God, his comedic career, and John has built his not only acting career, but also his directing career. And Doug is, you know, he's a fantastic, fantastic. Isn't he going to do that space movie with Tom Cruise now? That they're going to actually shoot in space?
They're talking about it. I don't know. We haven't talked about it. I'll tell you, Jon Favreau, the thing that's amazing about him is that when he was on the set of Rudy, he was always around the director. I mean, it was so clear that this guy wanted to direct and that he would direct. You know, he was constantly around the director, picking his brain. You know, it was like it was very clear that this was a guy that would one day be sitting in the director's seat.
And launched the biggest movie franchise in the history of cinema.
Yep. There you go.
Can you imagine if you would have said, oh, the guy from Swingers
right. Is
going to launch a multi-billion dollar franchise that Hollywood has never seen before?
Yep.
And now he's redoing it. And now he's heading up Star Wars, essentially. Right. So he's done okay. He's money. He's money, as they say.
He is money. Well, he's really smart and he really works hard.
You know? Yeah. So. And I hear he's the nicest, sweetest guy on the planet. The
sweetest guy. Yep.
I hear he's very, very. So then you got to work on another project from the 90s, which also is kind of a redefined genre, which is Scream. How did you get involved in Scream and how did it, was it like working with Wes?
This is a weird one because, you know, some of the people in my company, you know, some of the development people read the script and came into my office and said, you've got to read this script. This horror film came in. First of all, it was called Scary Movie.
Right, right.
You got to read this script called Scary Movie. I go, well, what is it? It's a horror. I said, look, you guys know I don't like horror movies, which is the truth. I'm not a big horror fan. They go, it's not a horror film. It is a comedic, it's a spoof on the horror genre. It's comedy. So I said, well, I like comedy and I like spoofs. So I read it. I loved it. It was hilarious. I read, I loved it. And I immediately called up the studio and I sent it over them. I said, we got to make this thing. So it was Miramax and they agreed. And I knew Drew Barrymore and I sent her the script for the lead, not for the part that we know that Drew Barrymore played. Mm. And she wanted to do it. And so then, you know, so then that was it. I drew Barrymore. I had a script and, you know, we were ready to go. So then that happened. But I then got I got a call from Drew a few weeks later saying that she wanted to play the part of girl number one. And I'm thinking, wow, okay, great, cool. So you want to play that? Like, how do you want to look different? Like, how do you want to do that? She goes, no, I only want to play girl number one. And I thought, oh, God, there goes the movie. My lead just left the movie. So I said, well, but that girl's dead on page 22. She goes, yeah, I know. I love that part. I want to do it. And I'll do anything else. I'll do any publicity or anything like that. Now, by this point, we had Wes Craven, mm-hmm. you know, he had come on, and so the film itself was more solid, you know, we had Wes Craven directing it, and she said, you know, I'll talk to Wes, and I'll explain it, and when she explained it, she said to me, look, if I die on page 20, whatever, then anything can happen after that. The audience, will nothing will surprise them, they'll be up for anything, because you know, if they've killed me on page 22, then anything could happen. And I knew she was right. And I went, I called Harvey Weinstein the next day. And I said, look, Drew doesn't, you know, wants to play girl number one, but she'll let us, you know, she'll do all the press that we want her to do. And, you know, you'll save millions of dollars because you won't have to pay her much. And you'll still... And he said, okay, let's do it. What does Wes think? And I said, Wes is fine. He said, okay, let's do it. And if you remember the poster for Scream One.
Oh, yeah.
Drew Barrymore's face.
Right.
That's it. She's in the movie for like 3 minutes. And the poster is her beautiful face with her blue eyes just, you know, shining out of the poster. It's hilarious.
It was Drew's idea to be that part. Drew's wasn't Wes's idea.
No.
Wow.
Drew Barrymore is brilliant. Some actors sometimes just have an instinct about these things that you just don't see. I mean, Matt Dillon had it about Drugstore Cowboy. You know, mm-hmm. Drugstore Cowboy was written for a 40-year-old man. You know, Gus wrote Drugstore Cowboy, you know, first line, 40-year-old Bob. And I was an agent and I gave it to Matt as a writing sample because I had just signed Gus as my client and I wanted him to hire Gus as a writer. And I gave him Drugstore Cowboy as a writing sample for the script that he wanted to write. He read the script. And he called me up. He goes, I have to see you. I go, why? He goes, I'll tell you at dinner. So we go to dinner. He goes, listen, I have to play this part. I go, Matt, the guy's 40 years old. We've already sent it to Bill Hurt, which we had sent it to Bill Hurt after Kiss of the Spider Woman. He goes, no, that's too old. He can't be 40 because if he's a 40-year-old guy who's been a drug addict since he's like 13, there's no. So persuaded me and I introduced him, you know, I set up a meeting with him and Gus and he persuaded Gus too. And he ended up being in Drugstore Cowboy. And it was purely because he saw something about that character being 20 years younger that the writer director didn't see and surely I didn't see. And, you know, we were connecting it to Drew saying that she should play the part of the girl number one. She didn't even have a name. She was just girl number one. Sometimes actors see things that we don't see. It's interesting.
And that's the brilliance of that movie. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I mean, if you don't kill Drew, I mean, spoiler alert for anyone listening, if you don't kill Drew Barrymore, if you don't kill Drew Barrymore off in the first 3 or 4 minutes of the film, I'm not sure the movie does well. It's the thing that it was the Hitchcock aspect of things. You know, you killed off your main lead. Well, wait a minute. I just killed off Drew Barrymore. Everything's out the window. And it was just so perfect with the commentary on the horror genre and what Kevin Williamson's script was doing. And it was a remarkable script. Now, I got to ask you though, with working with Wes, what was it like working with, kind of like a legend, and he was I think at the top of his game at that point.
What it was like was, yes, sir, what else do you need?
Yes, you Wes, know, what doing, else can I get needed?
You're doing a horror movie with Wes Craven, and I'm not even a guy, and even if I was, it didn't matter. I'm not even a guy who like pretended to, have a great interest in the genre, a great knowledge about the genre. All I knew is that I had Wes Craven directing a horror movie, so that was it. You know, whatever he needed was what my job was, and he was a pleasure to work with.
Now, how did you get involved with Copland, another film that just is, one of the starting films for James Mangold, who's had a decent career since then?
I saw Heavy at Sundance, which is James Mangold's first movie, and I flipped out for it. I just flipped. And I'm very director-centric. You know, if I see a filmmaker that I really like and that's interesting, I want to talk to them and meet them and see what they're interested in, and so I saw Heavy at Sundance, and Jim was there. And, it's a beautiful little movie. I don't remember if at the time movies were selling for a lot at Sundance, but it wasn't that kind of movie. It wasn't going to be like a big commercial thing, but beautifully done. And I met with him and I said, well, do you have anything you want to do next? He goes, yeah, I want to do a contemporary Western. It takes place in a police, and he pitches me Copland. I go, that sounds really great. You know, when you're done writing it, can I read? He goes, I'm done writing it. So I said, great, let me read it. So I read it. I love it. I say, I want to do it. I go down to Harvey. I go, I think I found our next movie. And I give him Copland. And then, and he loved it too. And then, sent it to John Travolta. They had just finished Pulp Fiction, and he sent it to John Travolta to play the lead. And I remember going down to meet with John Travolta, who liked it, but who, as he put it, wanted to get paid. And what he meant by that was that apparently on Pulp Fiction, no one got paid.
No.
And Pulp Fiction then became a big, giant hit. And John Travolta now was back at what his price would be on the open market, which was nowhere near what Harvey was going to pay him.
Right.
So he said, look, I love it. I want to do it. Tell Harvey, I just want to be paid. And okay. And then an agent at William Morris, I think. Sylvester Stallone was at ICM at the time, and somebody at William Morris who was trying to sign him sent him the script, because an agent thing to do is to send a script to somebody at another agency that their own agent might not have thought of them for, which is what happened here. Stallone had never heard of the movie, and he read it. He loved it. He was down in Florida. He offered to fly up to New York and meet. We met him, he said he was going to gain weight. He couldn't have been any nicer or any more respectful. I mean, it was like, the opposite of things that you heard about Sly Stallone. And, you know, he was going to be working with a first time, well, a second time filmmaker, but essentially, you know, a first time filmmaker. And couldn't have been a nicer, more respectful guy. Couldn't have been. And he, you know, he worked as hard as he could work on that part. And I think he did a great job. I think he was great. Yeah.
And how did you put together that cast? I mean, it's an insanity of a cast.
It's always the script.
Really? You
know? It's always about, it's about the script and the director. You know, if you have a script and a director who can go into the room and persuade the actor that he's going to get what is on the page, if the actor likes what's on the page, you're going to get him. He's not going to do it because he likes you, because you're a nice guy and you'd be a good guy to go out to a game with. You know, it has to be, these are artists and they want to do something that's going to challenge them. And that was a really, really good script. And then, of course, as we kept going, this cast started to become better. So then the actor was like, well, wait a minute, you've got De Niro and Stallone, and that, you know, so then all of a sudden it becomes like a snowball effect with, like, you know, and then Harvey Keitel, you know, and it's like all of a sudden, yeah, you know, now you want to be part of it.
Nobody wants to get to the party first, but once the movie is dating a pretty girl, all the pretty girls want to come.
Exactly right. Well, we had a lot of pretty girls at that party.
There's no question. I mean, you're looking at, Robert Patrick, Ray Liotta, like, the list just goes on and on. You just watch that movie, you're like, how'd they get this guy? Holy cow. It was, and Stallone is probably one of his best performances throughout his career.
You can go out as a producer and say, oh, well, I'm so amazing. And it isn't, you don't have a script. You could be, whatever you are, you have to have a script and you have to have the right talent, director right. that's going to be shooting it. You know, and then you can be made to look good as a producer if you have those two things. You know, without them, I don't know what else you can do.
Right, so. Exactly. Now, you also worked with a young filmmaker, a writer director by the name of M. Night Shyamalan on his first feature called Wide Awake, which he's completely nothing to do with his career. As far as his path, but yet you worked with M. Night at the very beginning of his career. What was that experience like?
Autobiographical, very nice guy. Here's the thing about M. Night: first movie or second movie, he did a little thing in India before that, but he carried himself again like Larry Clark. He carried himself like he had directed 20 movies. I mean, this guy knew filmmaking, right. And he knew what he wanted to do. And he's going after it. He was a pleasure to work with. This was the kind of thing where his Indian movie and the power of his talking about his script and about what the movie was going to be and just his intelligence made us feel, and it wasn't a very expensive movie, made us feel like, well, yeah, we want to work with this guy. And that was M. Night Shyamalan.
And then, as they say, the rest is history when he wrote that little ghost movie.
That little ghost movie, correct.
Did he mention the ghost movie while you guys were working together or not?
No, unfortunately. He and the Weinsteins had a falling out. Shockingly, another director that didn't want to work with them ever again. And just my luck, I'm stuck there. And he goes off and does that movie, you know, and I'm just like, you know, nothing I can do about it because I still had my deal where I was stuck at Miramax.
Right.
So, So there were a number of those over the years.
Jesus. Yeah, historically. I'm sure there was a couple of drinks after Sixth Sense came out.
Yes. Yes, there were. Listen, I love him. I wish him nothing but the best. And I surely understood why he didn't want to do anything with those guys again. So, you know, no quarrel from me.
Of course. And then, you know, so you've been living during your career at this point, you've been living in the indie world, in the Miramax world, you know, and basically in the heyday of Miramax, which was the 90s, basically from the early 90s all the way into the early 2000s. And then you got to jump into a very deep pool working on a huge, big budget blockbuster like Godzilla with Roland Emmerich, who is, you know, arguably one of the best action directors and spectacle directors, honestly, I think, in the history of cinema. What was it like, and what did you take away from that experience from working on smaller budgets, you know, smaller films to jumping to?
The truth of the matter is that it went backwards. I worked on the big ones first. I had my deal at Sony before I did Kids or Gummo or Citizen Youth or any of those. You know, Godzilla was an odd thing because I was dealing with a guy. I was chasing down the rights to Mr. Magoo. Mm-hmm. And there was a Japanese company called Toho Toha that represented, that owned the rights. And there was a guy in the valley who represented them in dealing with people who wanted to come to them for the rights. And I came to them for the rights, well, came to him to see if the rights for Mr. Magoo were available. And they were. And I went back to TriStar and Columbia, which is where my home was. And they wanted nothing to do with Mr. Magoo. And despite the fact, I have to go tell the guy from Magoo that they don't want to do it, even with Mike Myers. They didn't like the dailies on Axe Murder. That's a whole other story I'd rather not even get into because it's so aggravating. But, I mean, Mike Myers was a comedic genius as far as I was concerned. And the studio didn't like the dailies of So I Married an Axe Murderer. So consequently, they didn't want to get the rights to Magoo for Mike Myers to write and star in Magoo. I mean, think about that.
That would have been
but
fun.
In any event, I had to go back to the guy and say, look, I'm really sorry, but the studio is passing. He goes, oh, that's too bad. But you know what just became available is that my clients own the rights to Godzilla. And up until now, the director who created it was alive, and he didn't want to share the, he didn't want us to option the rights to an American studio, but he passed away sadly a month ago, and now my clients are willing to do it. And I'm Godzilla. So I raced back to the office, and they said no. And I had worked for Peter Guber, who was their boss. He was the chairman of the studio over, you know, Columbia and TriStar. I tracked him down and, you know, basically he's like, well, how's it going? I go, well, not that great. This is what happened. And he goes, the rights to Godzilla, the fire-breathing monster? I go, yes. He goes, oh, no, we have to do that. Leave it with me. And then and that was it. They got the rights. No one was happy with me, but nonetheless, we got the rights to Godzilla.
And you said so you had to jump. You had to jump over a couple people's heads to get that project greenlit.
It was the kind of thing that you're not supposed to do. So,
of
like,
course
I thought
not.
If I was taught politics at a studio 101, I broke every possible rule.
But it's Godzilla, man.
It's Godzilla, man. Yeah, it was Godzilla. And, you know, just sometimes it just happens so often when you just know somebody is missing, you know, somebody is missing something here. Anyway.
And I remember when Godzilla came out, it was the marketing budget on that film.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. It was everywhere. I remember they took big chunks out of like the Empire State Building or something like that. Like they put a banner and it looks like. Literally, there was a chunk missing.
The premiere screening in New York was at Madison Square Garden. The marketing was brilliant. You know, you have to say, size does matter. I mean, they were having so much fun with it, you know. It was fun. It was a fun project to make and to market. You know, it's Godzilla.
What was and that, obviously that was probably the biggest budget thing that you'd ever worked on, correct?
Oh yeah, by a lot.
Right. So what was? Is there any little lessons or gold nuggets that you kind of pulled away from that experience?
You're gonna do a movie that size, have a director like Roland Emmerich. So, you know, it's having some experience in doing movies of that size is really, really important because it's not what I did. You know, it's not my thing. He knew exactly what he was doing. So,
yeah, it's remarkable. It's remarkable now that they give Marvel movies to younger, inexperienced directors, or just they maybe have one or two indies under their belt, and they get thrown into this $150 million beast.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But I think that's a machine.
I think the infrastructure is in place right now where the line producers and everything else, where you basically can put somebody in there who creatively puts together, who talks about what it is they want to do. And then they've got this giant team of people who can make it happen at budgets that work for them. And obviously the budgets are generous, but they've now got it down to a science, especially at Marvel. How many of them a year are they turning out?
Three to four, if you include the Sony stuff.
Right. They've got it down to a science.
It's a factory. Yeah, and there's, you know, those kind of movies. God, I just remember seeing Godzilla. It was freaking everywhere, man. Like, there's, almost reminded me of Batman 89. Like, it was at that level of marketing. It was.
Well, you got to remember the guys, the producers of Batman,
right?
Now, chairman of the studio that put out Godzilla.
Makes perfect sense.
It's probably not a complete coincidence.
Now, what are you working on now? What are the projects you're working on now?
Well, we just finished shooting a movie that John Slattery directed called Maggie Moore, starring John Hamm and Tina Fey. It's based on a true story of a killing that happened about 30 years ago outside of Houston. Two women about the same age, pretty much kind of nondescript in their 40s. They were both murdered 3 days apart, about 30 miles from each other.
Wow.
And the thing about it is that they both had the same name. So really? 3 days of murders, 3 days apart, 30 miles apart, pretty much the same age with the same name. They investigate and the authorities conclude that it's a coincidence.
Of course it is.
Our writer, Paul Birnbaum, reads about it and thinks, no possible way. Is that a coincidence? So he concocts a tale. This was on America's Unsolved Mysteries. I mean, Robert Stack did an episode on this. Our writer saw it and thought, this is perfect fodder for like a, you know, Fargo-like black comedy, which he wrote and is great. And Slattery found it and he put it together. And, Hamm and Faye are incredible. Nick Mohammed from Ted Lasso is in it, and he's great. I love him in Ted Lasso. And so I'm excited about that. We just wrapped that a couple of weeks ago. And I'm doing a teeny tiny little movie called Man with a really talented, who I think you spoke to, called Steve Friedman, who's like a 21-year-old kid who basically put together a movie for like $15,000 as a crowdfunded thing. And somebody brought him to my attention and I took a look at, you know, a few minutes of it and just spoke to him for a little while. And it was clear that I was talking to a filmmaker.
He has a very interesting story and he's going to be on the show, in probably a few weeks after you air, but,
He's very much one of a kind. He's from a TikTok generation. He's an old soul from a different generation.
Yeah, he is, and very much so.
And he's really smart and I think really talented. And I don't know many people who love movies as much as he does. I mean, he truly loves cinema. And he's a throwback. And he's 21. So I'm really curious to see what the future holds in store for him, and I have no doubt it'll be great things. But it's fun. It's fun working with, you know, another 21-year-old director kid. You know, it's been a while for me.
And he probably has. And he probably has a ghost movie that he's going to direct soon after.
Oh, I would imagine. But this time I'll be the producer.
There you go. This time you're not going to let that go.
Yeah, no, this time, yeah. He's not having a fight with the studio.
You're the studio. You're the studio at this point.
I am the studio, right. No, he's I don't know that his ghost movie is going to be the next one. But he'll be doing whatever it's going to be. It'll be interesting.
Now, as a producer, Cary, I mean, we all, you know, being on set and working in projects over the years, there's always that day that everything's around you everything is crashing down around you. There's, you're losing the sun, an actor doesn't show up, the camera's broken, the director has a fit. Something happens as a producer that the whole world's coming down, crashing around you. Is there a specific project or day that sticks out in your mind, and how did you overcome that day?
That's an interesting question. For me, it's different than a day on a set.
Okay.
For me, it's more like the movie's going away. In other words, like for me, once we're on the set, the movie's happening. So there's a day, and you're gonna have a problem with that day. You'll fix it somehow. To me, I'm the bigger calamities is, oh shit, they're not making the movie. You know, the bigger calamity for me was getting the phone call from my lead, you know, Drew Barrymore, like, I don't want to play the lead. I want to play the girl who's gone on page 20. You know, and I'm on the phone and I'm seeing the movie go away. I'm seeing myself having to go, oh, well, we lost the lead, so they're not going to make that movie. And there's that. You know, it's more like those are the kinds of things. I mean, the other kinds of things, I mean, I've never gotten the calamitous call, you know, like my director's mother died or my, there are those. Look, we're human beings and we live human lives, you know, so like there's divorce, there's death, there's all accidents that can kind of happen. But even those things, you know, will close you down for a couple of days, but you're still making the movie. The other kinds of things where you're just, your movie's gone, you know, it just went away. You lost your lead, or the money is not coming in. You know, the money changed their mind, or those are more the kinds of things that I've had to deal with. And Drew is probably the best example of one where it was like, oh God, there it goes. It's over. Then I have to get ready to have the meeting where I'm going to go try. Now I was sold. She sold me, you know, I mean, creatively. I was totally sold creatively. It wasn't about saving money. With them, it was going to be, hey, you're going to save X amount of millions of dollars, you know, and it's a good idea creatively. So I was plotting how I was going to sell it to them. But, you know, I got lucky that they saw it that way, and they ended up making, well, they got lucky too, and they ended up making the movie, but it could have easily gone another direction.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions, ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
At what end? A filmmaker?
As a director.
Shoot. Go out there and shoot stuff and put it on YouTube and get it up, and as much as you can, shoot. And if you can write, write as much as you can write. Because look, it's a different era. You know, when I started in this business, saying to some kid, go shoot. Well, how am I going to shoot? A camera costs $60,000. Right. Well, now you can go get yourself a phone for $500 and shoot, you know, and all you need is a couple of friends or a couple of actors. Do what Tzvi did. You know, that's basically, Tzvi is the model of a guy who didn't have anything. He had a phone and he started shooting things and cutting it on the actual phone himself and putting it up on YouTube. And there are a lot of people who are doing that. And now there are a lot more places than YouTube. And there's TikTok and there's Instagram. And there's, just go out and do your thing, because there's no reason not to, because there's no barriers to entry as it relates to economics.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
One of the biggest bands, the thing that gets in the way of people both in life and in art and in this business and many businesses, ego. Put your ego aside. You don't have to be overly modest, but none of that means anything. What means something, speaking since we're talking about movies, is what's on the screen.
Right.
You know, what ends up on the screen with your name on it? That's all really that needs to matter. You know, the rest of it is like, what position credit are you and all of this kind of stuff. It doesn't really matter at the end, you know, because you can ask me about a lot of people and a lot of movies and I won't know what position they were in. I'll just know if their name was on the movie or not. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, Jim Brooks, a great filmmaker, once said to me, because he was having a screen, I was developing something with him, and he's having a screening of a movie he had just finished, and he invited everybody in the office to the screening. And very often, you know, a lot of filmmakers are really precious about who gets to see early right. cuts of their movies. And he was invited, I mean, the receptionists and the secretaries and everybody. And I said to him, hey, Jim, how, you know, you're really generous with who you invite to your early screenings. You know, well, how come you feel so comfortable doing that? And he said, hey, look, these are just stories. And everybody can have ideas about stories. And so therefore, they can have a good suggestion. And if they do, at the end of the day, it's going to say directed by Jim Brooks. And I thought, that is, it's both humble and it's confident, you know, and it's smart, you right. know, and that's the truth. At the end of the day, what's up on the screen is what's going to matter. The rest of it is all just noise.
Great, great, great lesson. Now, and lastly, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, God.
Whatever comes to mind right now.
I mean, come on. Well, look, you know, it's like me, okay, The Godfather, shockingly. Me, sure. Mean Streets.
Marty.
Oh, and then where do I go from there? Well, I'm going to exclude any of my own movies because they could be in there, but, I mean, just because it's Citizen Kane, I have to say Citizen Kane.
Sure. Hey, that's a very respectable list. Very, very respectable
mean,
list.
You know, you don't want to say, oh, well, yeah, Citizen Kane and The Godfather, but then you watch them and you're, yeah, how else can you not?
I mean, yeah, so. I mean, my list is always generally it fluctuates, but it's, you know, it's Shawshank Redemption, Fight Club, The Matrix, Blade Runner. I mean, the list goes on and on. Pulp Fiction.
Yeah. There's so many.
There's so many. But I always like this, like, what's coming at the top of the head? What's the mic throwaway? Like, if it comes on TNT or if it's seen on streaming or something like that, you just throw the remote away and you just keep watching.
It's also, what have you seen? I mean, I saw Mean Streets not too long ago. I'm talking about showing my son The Godfather. All of this has been happening in the last 3 weeks. And I guess I was talking about Citizen Kane. I mean, you know.
It's fresh in the mind.
Citizen Kane, yeah. But I mean, if I would have seen about a year ago or so, I saw Goodfellas at the Film Forum in New York. You know, if you talked to me a week after that, it would have been Goodfellas instead of Mean Streets.
As it should be.
Yeah.
it's a masterpiece, you know, as well. It's a tough thing. It's a tough thing. But Cary, I really appreciate you coming on the show, my friend, and
my pleasure,
and sharing
really fun.
And sharing your knowledge with everybody. So I appreciate it, and please keep making great movies, my friend.
Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it.
I want to thank Cary so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Cary. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch his new film, American Underdog, which I highly, highly recommend, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/191. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. And on a side note, guys, I just want to thank you all for listening and sharing this information that we have at Bulletproof Screenwriting, because it has become one of, if not the biggest, screenwriting podcast on Apple and Spotify. I've been seeing the numbers, and it is so humbling that the show has grown so much over the last couple of years. It has grown faster than I ever expected it to. So humbly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for all the support. Please continue to share this information. I want to help as many screenwriters and filmmakers out there as humanly possible. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.